right thing for you. CKUT 90.3 FM. Good evening. It's 6 o'clock, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional student and community productions in and around Montreal, Chautauqua, Mooneyang, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, January the 6th, 2021. A very happy New Year to you. On tonight's show, I look back at some of my favorite interviews from the past year, two playwrights, and one stellar performer. My guests, playwright Emily Monet on her trilingual play, Okinam.
The three languages make up of my identity. So I wanted to include those three languages, and also because I find that Indigenous languages are not heard enough on stages.
Playwright Arthur Holden.
But for me, if anything, the effect of COVID, the effect of staying home, was to focus my mind a little bit. I tend to be a writer who dwells a little more on intimate subjects rather than on social themes. So I guess, I have a kind of a private outlook to start with. And being private, you know, being told by the government, you must stay home, gave me added opportunity and added impulse to look inward.
And singer and performer Lynn Tremblay on staying motivated.
Just me, who is such a contact to people person, right? And doing it with this, break the lens of the camera and go right through it and just talk to the people out there, you know, like that's my goal. And anyway, there's no good time, so I might as well, you know, go, let's get to it.
So the English theater scene has yet to warm up in the new year, 2022, but arts venues also remain closed for the time being as the province continues to report high COVID case counts and hospitalization rates. The closing of venues also coincides with other measures like the nightly curfew, the closing of gyms and restaurant dining rooms, just to name a few. But since things are still a bit quiet, I thought I would revisit some of my favorite interviews from 2021, starting off with a writer who had a very big year. Emily Monet grew up in the Outaouais region, as well as Brittany, France, where her father is from. Her mother, who grew up speaking English, is Anishinaabe. Emily is now based in Montreal, also known as Mooneyang in Anishinaabemowin, a third language that she speaks and is continuing to learn. Emily's one-woman ode to reclaiming language and history is titled Okinam. It was shortlisted for the 2021 Governor General's Award for French Language Drama. In Anishinaabemowin, the word Okinam translates to a dam. Emily uses this as a metaphor here for both breaking down barriers and growing to trust herself. It's actually inspired by a recurring dream she's had and fueled by outdoor and inner exploration. First presented back in 2018 at the Théâtre d'Aujourd'hui, Okinam has won rave reviews in French, winning the 2021 Indigenous Voices Award for Prose in French. It received its English language premiere of sorts at Centaur's Brave New Look series in early September, presented in English, French, and Anishinaabemowin with surtitles. This was a co-production by Monet's company, Onishka, and Imago Theatre. Imago specializes in stories about unstoppable women, and Onishka presents stories through an Indigenous lens, while building relationships between Indigenous artistic communities and their English and French counterparts. Onishka itself translates to wake up. I spoke with Emily before a rehearsal last August. Welcome to Upstage, Emily. Thank you so much for taking the time. We're catching you just before a rehearsal, I believe.
Yes. I'm full in rehearsals right now. It's pretty crazy.
How are you feeling heading into this show? It's your English language premiere.
Yeah, it is. The show is still a trilingual show, So there's a lot of there's still a lot of French and way more Anishinaabemowin than in the first incarnation of the work. But I also have to get into the French again because I'm going to be performing at the NAC in the week of the 15th to the 18th of September. And so I have three shows in English and then I have three shows in French. So it's kind of a, you know, my mind organization kind of to juggle the two versions at the same time. But but I still have a bit of time.
It's really impressive to hear people switch between languages, never mind two, but three. And that's what you're doing here. Why was it important to incorporate English, French, and also Anishinaabemowin into this piece?
Well, because they form the three languages of my identity. My my father is French from France, and my mother is Anishinaabe, Algonquin. And so she doesn't speak Anishinaabemowin, but my grandfather does. And she was raised in English. So the three languages make up of my identity. So I wanted to include those three languages. And also because I find that Indigenous languages are not heard enough on stages. And I find that very, how can I say in English? I believe they should just be more present and people should be hearing the sounds of language because it's the languages that are born from this territory. So it's really important that we have space to include them.
I wholeheartedly agree. And thank you for doing this kind of work because I think it is bringing different perspectives to our audiences, either ones they didn't grow up with or maybe ones that they did and are reconnecting with. I was wondering about how you learned to speak Anishinaabemowin. You said your mother didn't grow up speaking it. Your grandfather did. Were there classes that were put in place or is this something you encountered when you were older?
Yeah, it's more of a recent initiative of mine too. So I've started I would say 8 years ago. And it started, we had kind of a language nest that we created in Montreal. We're all women, all Algonquin, Anishinaabe women. And we would meet at each other's places. And our teacher, her name is Veronique Tusky. And we would meet with her maybe once a week or every 2 weeks. And we would, we would learn language together. And then with Native Montreal, they have classes that they offer for the community. So I've continued with them and also with Veronique on my own. So having private lessons with her.
And the title of your show, Okinam, is an Anishinaabe word. It means dam.
Beaver dam. Yeah.
It means it's very central to the whole crux of the story. So why don't you walk us through this beautiful story that you're unfolding?
Yeah, so Okinam is based on this recurrent dream that I've had three times of a beaver, a giant beaver the size of a black bear that comes and visit me in my dream and tells me something and gives me something too. And I've had this dream three times, the exact same dream. So it's always felt like it was an important dream and I wanted to decipher it. And then Okinam, well, it is the word for dam. So that became kind of a metaphor for the journey that one's embarked to get away all those pieces of woods or the blockages that we all have, the inner blockades that we have, and what is the journey to remove these pieces of wood so that the water of memory can flow again. So it's really kind of a poetic take on these issues, and the beaver kind of is my guide in this.
I'm wondering, getting this dream the first time, you know, as an artist in the creative process, was it just kind of like, oh, I had a dream, that's interesting, okay, it happens a second time? Maybe by the third time you start to realize, like, you know, you're getting a message of some sort, but how does that translate into I want to pursue this creatively and do something with this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think dreams are really my main source of inspiration. I have a practice of really writing them down. And so I have many journals of dreams. And sometimes I let them, you know, sit there, and then I'll pick one up after some time. And I'm always fascinated about what comes out. There's always like strong, strange associations that you can make. Or I feel very lucky and grateful for the dreams I have. I have really vivid dreams, and I have a lot of like words that are being whispered to me in my dreams. So it's just something that I really like, to just be able to figure out what it means. And I find that art or my practice is a way to kind of dive into them and find or reveal the meaning. And so I felt I was inspired or called by this dream, and I felt I wanted to write about it. And that's really how it started.
I'm speaking with Emily Monet, who is presenting Okinam at the Centaur Theater as part of Brave New Looks in early September. Emily, what happens with your creative process once you said you keep dream journals and you sometimes let things sit? And once you've chosen to maybe follow a dream to pick up a thread, how does your process as an artist evolve?
Well, I think my practice is mostly in theater, but it really comes from an interdisciplinary perspective. So I really like when all the mediums, the different languages can come together and create its own language. So I've been working very closely with sound designer Jackie Galland from the beginning. And I've always loved to record sound. So I've recorded lots of sounds of beavers all the time, and nature, and also my Anishinaabe Mohan lessons too. So that's always been a very big part of my process, to integrate all those recordings, audio recordings, and see how they can really coexist with live text or more poetry, and have them all integrated to kind of create a new language, basically. So I'm hoping that this play is more, it feels more like an experience than being you know, a witness of something, but that we're all living a collective experience together throughout this performance.
Well, I just want to cite some of the praise for your show, the French version that you performed earlier on. Le Devoir called it a vast healing ritual, impossible not to be moved. So you're talking about on the grand scheme of bringing the audience together through something, and clearly it's very effective. I wanted to touch on the live sound that you're recording. I'm wondering where you went to go get live sound. Were you possibly looking to find beavers or beaver dams? I know they're very elusive creatures, so I don't know if this question is coming out of nowhere.
Well, no, I have a special connection to beavers, the Amik, so they kind of show up when I'm looking for them, or when I'm hoping to find them. So I often have a recorder with me, and I just pulled it out. There was also a beaver sanctuary next to Wakefield, so in the Outaouais. So I went to visit over there. I didn't get recordings, but the owner of the place, he had a lot of footage. Like, he put a GoPro into the beaver lodge. Wow. So he gifted me with all that footage. So that was a nice gift. So and then, you know, I go and pay my visits and ask permission to record them, and then often they show up and they allow me to record their sounds. But I also went there's wild animal zoo in like Lac Saint-Jean. Mm-hmm. And so I went there with a friend from Master Yash, and we were able to get our mic right on the nose of the beaver. So then we have all these great sounds, and then of course Jackie makes her own sounds and transforms them too to make something really unique.
And she's an incredibly talented artist and has a lot of rooting in rock music as well.
Yeah.
Alternative sounds. Mm-hmm. Is that a little bit of why you've chosen to work with Jackie?
Yeah. Well, yeah, totally. Like, I really like her work with synths and just kind of her punk approach kind of to me. music. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was always very in awe of her talent and her versatility. And I was invited, when was it? It was in 2017, I think. I was invited to Argentina and Uruguay and Paraguay to present something. And I decided, oh, well, I have this new piece that I'm working on and I could present a work in progress. So Jackie came with me. So I feel, you know, we've embarked on that, this adventure together since the beginning. She's very much part of the piece, yeah.
I'm speaking with Emily Monet, who is presenting Okinawa at the Centaur Theatre in early September. I'm curious about going out into the, not the wild, but being outdoors and being rooted in the moment, the observations you're taking in. But of course, then we do the work and we come back to a theater space and you're presenting in front of an audience. Before you start a show, do you do anything to kind of root yourself, to take yourself back to being outdoors, being near a beaver dam, you know, to really evoke that feeling in yourself as you hit the stage?
Well, it's hard to do it in Montreal because you don't have access to nature in the same way, but but yeah, I do have my own kind of rituals or ways to get into the mode, the performance mode, and to be really connected to what I'm saying. I mean, I'm right now I'm really in the work and trying to get all my lines good and my songs. And so, yeah, I guess I'm really, really in the work right now. So I'm supposing that the days of the performances, I will find ways to ground myself into being able to share it the most generously possible.
Well, Emily, can't wait to see that actual performance. I've heard so many wonderful things about it. So thank you so much for taking the time today and break a leg on this performance, your English language world premiere. But of course, there's three languages on stage. Wishing you all the best.
Thank you very much. Merci, Miigwech.
That was Emily Monet, the writer, creator, and performer of Okinawa. The English language version of her show premiered last September at Centaur Theatre. Of course, it also included elements in French and in Anishinaabemowin. The show was shortlisted for the 2021 Governor General's Award for French Language Drama. So Emily Monet is definitely someone to watch. You can learn more about her company and work at onishka.org, O-N-I-S-H-K-A, and Imago Theatre is at imagotheatre.ca. I'm Sarah Day. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week on Thursday, January 6th, 2021. I'm looking back at three of my favorite interviews from the past year. Still to come, you will hear a story of a talented singer, her life on the road, and how to stay motivated when you're at home.
COVID-19 is quickly circulating throughout the province of Quebec. It's essential that you get tested only if you have COVID-like symptoms. Symptoms such as fever, cough, and loss of taste or loss of smell. As you may already know, testing still remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. For more information, visit quebec.ca/test COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
You're back with me, Sarah Day, host of Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. Arthur Holden is a Montreal-based actor and playwright, and a play he has written over the course of the pandemic beat out over 600 other submissions to be included in a huge theater fest in Los Angeles this past summer. I spoke with Arthur in July to learn more about his new work, Beloved, a play in three waiting rooms, a story that finds a married couple struggling with the actions of their son. Arthur Holden started working on his play over the past summer, 2020. He has a long list of plays under his belt, including Book of Bob, Battered, and Fatherland. He says he likes to weave intimate stories about relationships and the stresses within them. In his new one, Beloved, we meet Dorothy and Stephen, a married couple that owns a company that is failing fast, but they are forced to confront another hard reality when they learn their son David has committed a disturbing crime at his high school English class. So while this play was read virtually last year during the SummerWorks Festival in Los Angeles, the company that runs the event has just announced that the play will be performed live this coming spring as part of its regular season. Beloved will get its world premiere in April, performed live in North Hollywood. For more information, you can visit roadtheater.org. Now, back in July, I was eager to speak with Arthur because he's so generous as a guest, and I was curious about how a writer's process would be affected by the enforced solitude of the pandemic. Is it a gift or a curse? Here is my conversation with playwright Arthur Holden. Welcome to Upstage, Arthur. Thank you so much for taking the time. This is kind of a funny time for writers, right? Because it's a very solitary activity, but to be in a pandemic, I don't know, how has that changed your routine and your creativity?
Well, that's a great point, Sarah. The whole COVID thing, which is now a year and a half old, it's just hard to believe, has been obviously a social and a public health nightmare. But I have to admit, from a purely personal artistic standpoint, it hasn't affected me. First of all, just out of, I guess, blind luck, no one I know well, has been affected, personally infected by the virus. I have a neighbor at the end of my street who caught it with his wife and children. And they were all pretty youthful and all got through it fine. And apart from that, I know of a couple of Montreal actors who got it and also got through it fine. So I haven't been personally touched by it. And then as an artist, my job is to sit alone in a room and write, and that's not really a COVID-friendly, unfriendly activity. So I've kept that up on an ongoing basis. I've done quite a bit of writing, actually. And felt guiltily fortunate for being able to go on doing what I love doing best and not being particularly stopped by this thing that has turned the world otherwise upside down.
Right. So your writing has continued unabated, but I wonder also in terms of creativity, not having maybe the same stimulation or the same brainstorming process, perhaps, because you weren't, leaving the house or having the same interactions. Did that affect the creativity process at all?
That's a really good question, actually. And I imagine there are artists for whom being shut down had a huge effect. But for me, if anything, the effect of COVID, the effect of staying home, was to focus my mind a little bit. I tend to be a writer who dwells a little more on intimate subjects, rather than on social themes. So I guess, I have a kind of a private outlook to start with. And being private, being told by the government, you must stay home, gave me added opportunity and added impulse to look inward. It's a really good question you're raising. I wonder if this thing went on indefinitely, I would think, oh, this is such an opportunity. I often ask myself, for instance, which is an odd question, if I were put in prison, if I were locked up, would that be a bad thing for my writing? And I often thought, no, just you and your feelings, that can be very productive.
Yeah, you would just keep ticking away, keep writing.
That's it.
You just mentioned the intimacy of your stories. They're kind of stories of families and people in relationships. So let's take that and move to Beloved, your new work. We meet a married couple and they're going through some personal struggles for sure.
Mm-hmm. The struggles have already begun, we realize, as the play opens, which it does in the waiting room of a principal's office in a high school. And this couple, Dorothy and Stephen, have been called to their son's high school because he's committed a disturbing crime, really quite a disturbing crime. I actually I'm not going to specify the nature of the crime because I'm hoping your listeners will tune in to hear the play read. But as the parents arrive and they have this thing explained to them, frankly, they're incredulous at first. They can't believe it. But as the circumstances in which the crime was discovered are explained to them, they pass from incredulity to a kind of shocked realization that, in fact, this could have happened and did happen. And then to a sense that differs between them as wife and husband, of how responsible they are and how specifically as individual, as parents, they are for the thing that their son has done. And that's really the trigger. All this sort of happens in the first 15 minutes of the play. And that event, the realization that their son has done something terrible and that they bear some of the blame for that, becomes the trigger for the play as it goes on. So it unfolds in a succession of institutional waiting rooms in which their son is never present. So the son, the person who committed the crime and who turns out to be suffering terribly, who turns out to have been a victim of very, very grave traumas, he's off stage throughout the play. And the person that Dorothy and Stephen, the persons that they interact with, are a succession of young professionals working for the institutions where the married couple is waiting. And these professionals explain background facts, they deepen the parent's sense of who their son is and how he suffered. And they start to point a way forward, even as the marriage between Dorothy and Stephen encounters terrible strains that might destroy it. I don't know, is that a clear explanation of what happened?
Indeed it is. I'm speaking with Arthur Holden, playwright and performer, and we're talking about his new play, Beloved, which is about to have a reading on July 30th. And I love this concept. The full title is Beloved, A Play in Three Waiting Rooms. And you've described it, you've quite given us quite an evocative kind of imagining of the show itself. How did you decide to structure it through these three waiting rooms? Obviously, we're kind of in this stasis. We're waiting for something to kind of happen. They're waiting for bad news and even worse news, I guess. But how did that form in your mind?
Yeah, well, I guess I should say that as an artist and as a person, I'm very interested in transgression. I'm very interested in what happens to the human spirit and to human relationships when people do things that are more or less universally regarded as bad, as destructive. And I can't think of an activity that is really more condemned, more universally condemned than, I'm going to talk about it a little bit, than the sexual exploitation of children. This play really turns on that subject. And I knew I wanted to write about that. And I knew I wanted to write about it with my central care, with a person deeply involved in this, being a young man. And as I began to write the play in this first of three waiting rooms, the school waiting room, I was fully planning to have the young man come on stage and for the play to become his struggle to explain. But as I began to write and as I began to imagine the young man's parents, who were much closer to my age and my life experience, it became plain to me that what I really wanted to write about was their response, the ways in which they were going to grasp what their son had done and the extent to which really they were to blame for it. And from being a struggle to explain, the play became a struggle to understand. And once I had that in mind, the plot, the structure fell into place quite quickly. I realized that it would always be this wife and this husband sitting in a waiting room, anxious to be told what was going on as they struggled themselves to understand the terrible suffering their son was going through.
You've kind of hit on this a little bit, but I'm wondering, does it make it more of a challenge to write out this character who is driving forward the plot rather than include him as you had initially intended to have the son who's committed this transgression you were going to have him in there and now he's always off stage. It was like a waiting for a Godot scenario.
A little bit. Eh? Well, that's a very good question. But in an instance like this, where the crime, which has to do with the sexual exploitation of children, is so very serious, so grave, I think that once you bring the person who has committed it on stage, necessarily that character is going to become the complete fulcrum of the play. And the concerns of those around him, while still important, will all sort of feed into the general dynamic of this address of what was done and why. And frankly, that's an area in which I would have had to do much more research. I'd have had to look into the kinds of personalities and psychiatric conditions that lead to and that proceed from that kind of behavior. And I feared, I had a couple of fears. First, that it was going to become a much more sort of medical psychiatric play rather than an emotional one. And second, that it was going to lead me into areas where I was trying to imagine something that at some level I don't really have a right to understand. You know, I was going to try and explain the conditions of a soul that were very far from my experience and, you know, to the extent that appropriation is an issue, very far from my authority to tell. Whereas talking about parents, talking about middle-aged parents, well, that's something I have authority to do. That's something I have been and am. And that, funnily, also, is just as a dramatic issue, was an area I was more interested in. You know, again, how do people respond to transgression? How do relationships, the network, the web of relationships in which we live, how is all that affected when someone we love does something terrible? And that, for me, was a very fertile ground. And once I had this structure of three waiting rooms set up, and the three young professionals to be played by the same young woman, mm-hmm. it really played itself out for me in a way that was quite organic. The writing didn't take too long. I wrote it in the summer of 22, the deep summer of COVID. And I wrote it for three specific actors, three Montreal actors, Al Goulem, Lenny Parker, and Stephanie Costa. Stephanie's now in Toronto. But when I realized that, you know, the opportunities for a reading just weren't going to arise, I sent the play in very late autumn of 2020 to the Rode Theater in Los Angeles, because they have an annual summer playwrights festival that's the biggest of its kind on the continent. And they had put out a call for scripts, and I sent Beloved in, you know, basically because I had nowhere else to send it. And I was very honored when they came back in March with an invitation to be part of the show, a part of the festival.
Yeah, we've got, I think, a dozen plays, new plays that are going to be read out loud here. Did you have any connections to Los Angeles before you submitted this play? Like, had any of your work been performed or read over there? Like,
never. In fact, I've had a couple of play readings in New York, but nothing ever on the West Coast. And this company knew nothing about me and I knew nothing about them, although I've subsequently learned they're a terrific company. They're quite small. They have a 100-seat house in North Hollywood. But, you know, Los Angeles being an industry town, they have some absolute dynamite actors. And in fact, their co-artistic directors, Taylor Gilbert and Sam Anderson, loved the show enough that they're co-starring in it. And they brought in a terrific director named Cameron Watson, who's a deeply experienced film and stage director, creator of an Emmy Award-winning web series. And they brought in a third actor, Cherish Monique Duke, who also has a deep resume and incredible talent. And the creative team that they, you know, put together was just stellar. I still can't believe how lucky I am.
So the neat thing is that even though this is happening in Los Angeles on the West Coast, the border won't even quite be, won't be open either way, land border by then, but you'll be able to, I assume, take this in on the web.
That is very true. We all will. It's funny, right? This is the Rode Theater's Summer Playwrights Festival is in its 12th year. But this is the second year that it's fully online and can be watched everywhere. And of course, you know, as a result, the numbers of people attending the festival have ballooned by an order of magnitude, because you don't have to get tickets to a 100-seat house. You can be anywhere on the planet. And apparently last year and again this year, they've had viewers from every continent in the world. They've had viewers tuning in, you know, from everywhere on the planet to see these new play readings. It's terrifically exciting.
So how will you take it in yourself, seeing this new play being read by this talented cast that you were describing earlier on? Do you have any special setup at home when it gets aired?
No, that you're raising a good point. No special setup involved, and I hope all your listeners will consider tuning in. The website is Rode Theatre, RODTHEATRE.org. And you go to that website, there's a big information page for the Summer Playwrights Festival. You go to that page and you get an immediate link right there on the screen to the reading, and also a YouTube link, because you can also watch it on the Rode Theatre's YouTube page. And this is happening on Friday, the 30th of July, at 6 p.m. Pacific time, which means 9 p.m. our time, which, as Barb Ford very helpfully pointed out a couple of days ago, is very convenient because it means the sun has gone down in Montreal when the reading starts. So, you know, apart from stargazing, and I guess going to a club, which may or may not be legal by then, you know, you can tune in for free and watch this reading of a Montreal play done by a terrific Los Angeles company.
Arthur, what would be your wildest dream for having this play? Like, you've had other plays performed and produced, but to have this one, this pandemic play being read on the other side of the continent in an industry town like this, like, what's the biggest hope that you would want to pin or want to confess to pinning on?
What a lovely question. The answer would be that this same team, Cameron and Taylor and Sam and Cherish, love the play enough after they've read it that they think, yeah, let's do this. And that the Rode Theatre in Los Angeles actually programmed the play for a full production, because I think they're going to be returning to actual real live theater production next year. And if they love this play enough to do it, that would be a dream come true.
How exciting. Well, Arthur Holden, congratulations on having this play being selected for the festival. And thank you for telling us, taking us behind the scenes to your process and to the intricacies of creating a play and setting it up like this. We appreciate it.
It is I who appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk, Sarah. And I hope your listeners consider tuning in to see to watch the reading.
That was Arthur Holden, author and playwright. His new play, Beloved, was performed online as part of the Summer Playwright Festival in Los Angeles last summer. And just a few days ago, the company that hosts that event, Rode Theatre, announced that Beloved will get its world premiere this spring, performed live in person in North Hollywood, California. For more information, visit RodeTheatre.org. And as just an aside, I also wanted to add about my guest, Arthur Holden, that he's also an actor. He has many voice acting credits, including video games like Assassin's Creed, and many TV shows, including the role of teacher Mr. Ratburn in the children's cartoon series Arthur. It stars a titular young anthropomorphic aardvark and his family and friends, based on a series of books by Mark Brown. And it's one of the shows I grew up with. There's Arthur, his sister DW, and their friends Buster and Francine and the rest of the gang, all ordinary animal/kids living in Elwood City. But they each had their own foibles and issues that they resolved with help from each other and the adults in their lives. Topics included getting along with friends, being patient, doing homework with dyslexia, bedwetting, and of course, there were celebrity guests like Joan Rivers, Larry King, and Fred Rogers. The same week I spoke with Arthur, it was revealed that the show would be coming to a close after 25 years, the longest-running animated children's show in U.S. history. The final series airs this year, 2022, and reruns will still be available on PBS Kids. And the thing about Arthur that you should know is that it was a co-production between WGBH Boston and CINAR, a Montreal-based production company now known as Wildbrain. Many of the voices were based in Montreal or who had played to Montreal audiences on the stage. There was Ellen David, who was on upstage several times this year, Danny Brochu, Bruce Dinsmore, Mark Camacho, Holly Gauthier-Frankel, and the late Walter Massey, just to name a few. So hats off to Arthur Holden, Arthur the show, and the many Montrealers who helped bring this series to children for over a quarter century. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. It's January 6th, and I'm looking back at three of my favorite interviews from the past year.
Are you age 60 and over? Now's the time to make your appointment for your booster dose against COVID-19. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to book your appointment online. To continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose and keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to Upstage, the show about theater on the radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Sarah DeA. It's not often that you get the chance to speak with someone who could fill hours and hours with stories about life on stage. Lynn Tremblay is one of those people. She grew up in a small Quebec town but started dancing at a young age. She arrived in Montreal as a teenager and launched her career in French, later moving to Toronto and overseas to star in musicals like Cats, Cabaret, West Side Story, as well as roles in TV and film. And as you will hear, Lynn eventually returned to Montreal. She's been working on her music. Her latest album, Get Into It, was launched last spring with a virtual cabaret and live band from her spectacular home in the Plateau. The 24th of April. Here is the sound
living
of that.
In limbo. Living in limbo. Have you been living in limbo? Whoa, whoa, whoa. We're going to fix that. We're gonna get you out of that limbo. Okay. Here in my loft in Montreal, the place where I spend all my days, all my nights.
Oui, on aura un petit pre-show à 19h15 et showtime 19h30, le 24 avril.
Get to it. Get to it. As you can see, there's somebody who lives with me who is a percussionist who will be in the show as well with two other musicians. A cameraman avec une steadicam wrapped around his body will follow the action around. Good luck with that, baby. Bilingual.
The show touched on her music as well as life under lockdown. Lynn is an entertaining person to speak with, and considering that we are back under lockdown life in Quebec, I thought it would be a fascinating conversation to hear this chat again. Get ready. Here is my conversation with Lynn Tremblay from last spring. Welcome to Upstage. Lynn, thank you so much for being here.
Hello. Well, thank you for inviting me.
So what's it like to be writing music and to be writing stories, monologues at this point in the pandemic?
It puts all our, everything that we've ever talked about, it just makes them really accurate right now, which is, you know, encouragement, self-care, be there for your friends, your family, who are in limbo, right? And having a rough time right now, because lots of my friends are artists and all the work just is gone. And, you know, trying to use a lot of humor and so I guess all these songs are finding new meaning for me, you know, putting them in this context and then writing some extra pieces to thread them, tricoter, like they say in French, you know? To put them all together with this arc of like, we're living in limbo, we're in this together, and we're all black and blue some days, and some days we go, oh, never mind, I'll be fine. But that's what I've been doing, like just trying to put this material and honor the launch of the album, Get to It, which was supposed to be last April. And then when we saw this, pandemic, it just didn't feel right anymore to put it out there. And but, you know, I don't even know if there is any right time right now to do anything. Everything is so in limbo, right?
To coin the title of your performance, Living in Limbo. Do you have this kind of feeling of, well, might as well do it now? Like, why wait any longer?
Well, yeah, because we just don't know how long we're gonna, even this show has been postponed twice. So to keep adrenaline, you know, adrenaline is my Instagram name, Adrenaline Music. But to keep it up, you know, to keep the energy up and say, okay, am I crazy for doing this? Should I cancel it? Should I do it? No, I got to do this. It's got to be done. It's got to be taped. And we have something there. You know, we have this tool that we can keep sharing. And, you know, and I need to get this. To get this out, it comes to a point where you go, I've been waiting, I've been patient, let's go, because I don't think this time is going to be the, especially now summer's coming out, you know, people have been probably in front of their screens a lot all winter, and I hope that they're going to be joining us on the 24th to just, you know, to be in front of their screen with us and having this kind of intimate experience from our living room to their living room. And, you know, like, I've been trying to think, how is that all going to work? Just me with such a contact to people person, right? And doing it with this, break the lens of the camera and go right through it and just talk to the people out there, you know, like, that's my goal. And anyway, there's no good time. So might as well, you know, go, let's get to it. That's why the album is called Get to It. It's been my mantra for a couple of years, you know, because this album just took a little bit of time to be born, if I may say, because I was living in Toronto for, you know, 30 years. My two girls are still there. And then I moved here and we started the recording of that album. And you know, just before I moved, moved back to Montreal and then got busy with so many projects and it got put on the back shelf there for a while. And then one day I said, I got to do it. Got to get to it. Got to finish what you start. My mom and dad raised me really well.
You use a lot of kind of like mantras. Mm-hmm. Are you someone who needs to kind of talk yourself into doing a lot of things? Do you need to motivate yourself?
Well, finishing the album was because I got so busy with other things. And then, you know, I said, I got to do that one day. So I came back to it and really focused on it. But, you know, I mean, we all have days where, especially when you're a freelance artist, you got to constantly self-motivate yourself, right? You don't have like a job 9 to 5. I mean, sometimes we do have contracts, but these days it's basically me who has to motivate Lynn and go, okay, let's go. You go down and let's go and vocalize and let's go and practice these songs and write some, you know, thoughts and how do you link all this and you know, do some research. And so you really have to self motivate yourself a lot, and some days are not as obvious as others, and you know, it's okay to take a day off too, right? Like, we have to be kind to ourselves. But yeah, it definitely, it's been this last year, it's been a real how do you say, like a challenge, but also like a realization that where your weaknesses are and where your strengths are, and you know, to forgive yourself and to just keep thinking positive. Yeah, I do a lot of talking to myself.
I'm speaking with Montreal-based triple threat Lynn Tremblay, releasing her second album, Get to It, on April 24th. We've been talking about your show as well. Can you just tell me about the logistics? You're actually performing, you're working from home. You're going to be performing on the 24th out of your loft space, which apparently is kind of like a marvel of design.
Well, yeah, this space, it's got so much, such a fabulous history too.
Can you describe it for me? What part of town are you in?
Which I will be talking, actually, like I will take, because I feel like this loft and the fact that we're doing it here with one camera, I decided to do it like one long continuous sequence shot, which I've been wanting to do for a long time, like with videos and stuff. So, you know, it's not going to be cut camera one, cut camera two. It's going to be one long shot, which I'm excited about that, because what you see is what we're going to see, what we're going to feel. It's going to be au naturel, acoustic. And this loft has got a beautiful acoustic, actually. And it was it was an old manufacturer, and then it became actually a manufacturer where they actually build sets from for CBC, Radio-Canada, which is not far from here. I'm south of Parc La Fontaine, and north of CBC, like, you know, on Rue Baudry. So it's a beautiful area now. We just walk up the hill and you're in that beautiful park, which I love. And anyway, so this place was actually a place where they build sets. And I used to be a professional dancer, and I did a lot of shows on for Radio-Canada, you know, the Bye Bye and all those specials, TV variety specials. So I was just saying that maybe I actually danced on sets that were built in this, my future home, which was, I don't know, you know, I think maybe. And they did costumes here. And I'm fascinated with the history of this building, actually.
That's so cool. There's so much history within that space.
I know. And you know, and there was, oh yeah, there was a lady that lived here too from CBC. And it just doesn't stop. It's a very creative space. Yeah. It's a beautiful vibe.
So you're going to draw inspiration from it, I'm sure. Speaking with Lynn Tremblay, who's presenting or launching her second album on April 24th, you just mentioned your past life as a dancer, which I guess is still kind of your current life as a cabaret performer. And I want to know more about your start in the entertainment business, because you were huffing at first, right? You were in Cats, you were in cabaret itself, West Side Story. Can you tell me about your start?
Well, you know, I started dancing when I was 9 in the living room at my house in Robertval, Lac Saint-Jean. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My dad bought this that big old square TVs, you know, they used to be so big and heavy. And we, Saturday night was musical comedy, film night, Hollywood with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rajah and Sid Cheris. And I just was riveted. I would stand in front of the TV with my pajamas and my big slippers, and I would imitate each one of their moves. And when my parents saw that I loved dancing so much, well, they got me into little ballet classes, you know, that little school in Robertval. And I'm sure we all have these moments in our lives where you just go, oh, something just happened for me. At one Christmas, our ballet teacher, or my teacher at the dance school, said, this Christmas, we're going to do something very unique. Everybody, I'm going to put some Glenn Miller music on, and everybody is going to do, in front of everybody, all the other girls, a little improvisation. And so I was like, oh, I can do that, because my parents had these vinyls of Glenn Miller and band, and I loved all that big that jazz stuff. And so I did my little improv, and I knew I had some moves there that the other girls didn't. My teacher finally paid attention to me, and she said, where did you learn to do this? And I just saw this little girl, shy, that was always felt like in the corner, you know, but like suddenly I just felt like I had something that I was somebody in that moment. And from then on, I kept doing classes, and we moved to Quebec City, and I was in this dance company and amateur, you know, with on-toe shoes. And my legs, for some reason, could go really develop against my ear, like, and I could just leave it there. And like, I had this thing in my hips that made me do that. So Eddie Toussaint one day from Montreal, with the Eddie
choreographer
Toussaint company, came to Quebec City, and my teacher then, Madame Molnar, invited him to come and see our little, you know, a performance thing. And he was blown away with my développé being so high and my drama, my drama dancing style. He offered me to join his company right there on the spot. And of course, that was like, I had to come home and tell my parents this, because I wanted to be a doctor. I loved the body. I loved how the body worked. And that's what I wanted, to be a doctor. But I love dancing. My parents were so gracious. They said, my dad, he said, Lynn, you know what? You can always go back to school one day and be a doctor of sorts, of any kind. You can only dance for so long. So you should go and do this adventure. And so I ended up moving to Montreal at 19 and joined the company. And we went right away on this fabulous tour in Guadeloupe, Haiti, and all South America, you know, and Medellin, you know, Bogota, Quito. And I was like, I never even took a plane at that time in my life. This big Air Canada, huge plane to go on tour with Eddie Toussaint. Yeah, that was, so that's the beginning of my career. And after that, then I ended up doing all these TV specials in Montreal. And because I left the company, I wanted more. I wanted to sing too and act. And, you know, just being a dancer was not quite enough for me at that time. So, I ended up joining and being, you know, one of the dancers on all these TV specials, which was really cool. And then I thought, okay, I need more still. I want to learn English. I want to see, you know, more musicals. And so I moved to Toronto and studied heavily dance, like 6 days a week, 2-3 classes a day. My technique really improved until the day I was asked to audition for Cats. And I was actually, it sounds crazy, but I was actually filming a film here called Night Magic with Carole Laure and Louis Fury and
Leonard Cohen.
Leonard Cohen wrote the music for this film. And so I was actually here in Montreal when they had the dance audition. And it was so funny because I worked so hard in Toronto getting my technique up and, you know, and everything. And when I auditioned here at Place des Arts in the big rehearsal room downstairs, I was with all my friends that I used to dance with. And I could really, really see the progress I had made, you know, because I used to dance with the same peeps. And I was pretty proud. Anyway, again, that Cats thing was the first big show ever in Canada, you know, a musical comedy of that magnitude. And I was offered a job right there on the spot too of Cassandra, the slinky and Siamese cat, which was, wow, woohoo, you know? And then just life keeps going. Then I moved to Europe to do cabaret at the Mogador, that was my first big role with singing and a big orchestra. And, you know, life just pushes us, huh? And in directions that you just never expect.
You have so many fantastic experiences that I feel like I could talk to you for hours. But just to wrap up, now you're a cabaret artist and you're telling stories and you're singing songs. You're launching your new album. Can you just maybe tell me a little bit about one of your songs, very quickly, about one of the songs you love the most on this album?
Oh, that's so hard. Because, okay, let's see. One of the songs is one I co-wrote with a friend in Toronto, and it's called Dancing Fool. Talking about, we're going to be in the dance mode here. And I wanted to talk about the way it feels when your body is so free and so no pain, you know, like you're just flying through the air, and what it feels like to be a dancer, you know, unpredictable waves of stomping, clapping, twisting, turning, you know, like, so, and it's a very up a song that, you know, you put it on and you just feel better and you just want to dance and move. And I think it's a perfect song for now because we're all a little bit black and blue, you know? So anyway, that's one of the songs that I just love. And it's an original song, which is nice. And it's my first love, you know, my first big love. Dance.
Then Tremblay, it's been such a delight to take some of your time and hear some of your stories. And there's more of that coming with your show later this month. Thank you so very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Sarah. Thank you.
That was performer Lynn Tremblay presenting her virtual cabaret to kick off her latest album, Get To It. The show is called Living in Limbo. She broadcast her show from her home last April. You can find Lynn Tremblay on YouTube for a trailer to her show to get a preview of how beautiful and gorgeous her home is. We're listening to some of that trailer right now.
We're gonna get you out of that limbo.
Okay.
Here in my loft in Montreal, the place where I spend all my days, all my nights.
On aura un petit pre-show à 19h15.
You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, a show looking back on some of my favorite interviews with theater makers from the past year. Tonight you heard playwright Emily Monet on her trilingual play Okinum, playwright Arthur Holden on his pandemic work Beloved, coming to a theater in North Hollywood later this year, and singer and performer Lynn Tremblay.
A very big thank you to my guests. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at CKUT.ca under the archives. Thank you to Jack Solar, our spoken word coordinator, for making sure this show gets to air. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeA. A very happy new year to you. This is the very first episode of a new year, and I'm looking forward to all the ones to come in 2022. I'll speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and CKUT.ca. Stay safe. Up next is Grey Matters.
Make an appointment for your booster dose against COVID-19. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence plan for your area and book your appointment online. To continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose and keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Happy New Year to you all, and welcome to tonight's edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show, we have a lecture by Chris Hedges, another one this month, and we'll have another one next week. This one is titled American Sadism. It was recorded in Troy, New York in June of last year. Chris Hedges is an award-winning journalist that has reported from the Balkans, the Middle East, Central America. Cornel West calls him the greatest radical writer and journalist of our generation. He writes a weekly column for SheerPost.com and is host of On Contact on RTTV. He's the author of many books, including American Fascists, Empire Evolution, Death of the Liberal Class, Wages of Rebellion, America, The Farewell Tour, and Our Class. So, without further ado, here's tonight's lecture, American Sadism. And next week, we'll hear the question and answer period for this show. Till next week.
Yes, the decorum of the Biden presidency differs from that of the Trump presidency, but the underlying mercenary exploitation and sadism of American society remains untouched. We will extract ourselves